Today's show is sponsored in part by ManageEngine and their OpManager network management software. OpManager integrates NetFlow monitoring, configuration management, firewall log management, IP address management, and more, all in a single product. Go to opmanager.com/packetpushers to get a free 30-day trial. Micronics boot camps are the real deal. You get detailed workbooks that show you not only what to do, but also the most important part of networking, verifying that what you've configured is working right. These boot camps aren't just workbooks and lecture, though. You also get time to work on equipment configuration with even more labs designed to teach specific concepts. So to learn from the best, head over to MicronicsTraining.com.
Welcome to Packet Pushers, the greatest data networking podcast in the world. Now, this is a future of networking podcast where I find a distinguished guest or somebody who is a well-known of repute to come and talk to you about a disturbing dystopian look into the future of networking. We've talked previously about whether IPv4 will ever go away. We've talked to Dref Houston about his views on DNS and IPv6. And today I'm joined by Douglas Goulet. Doug, please tell people a little about yourself.
Oh my gosh, what is there to know? Probably the thing I'm most distinguished for in my entire career is having been, I think, on like the first sponsored Packet Pushers podcast, Greg.
Yes, back in the days of Arista. You were,
yes,
back. Now, it was around about, show 150. I'll have to look it up. It's a long time ago.
Yeah, it was fairly early on. No, I spent a lot of time at Cisco, helped build the data center business over there, looked after a lot of the data center products, and then from a product management perspective, and then marketing and that solutions area for all of them. And then, early on at Arista, stayed there for a long time, and then spent the last 2 years at a pretty cool cybersecurity infrastructure startup called Skyport.
Yeah, so you've really had this long-term history, like at an executive level, not just you've been in marketing as well, but you've also been on an executive on the inside. You had a long-term history. If I remember rightly, you were involved with the CAT 6000 in its early days, its genesis, and through to its delivery.
Yeah, I was pretty early on the CAT 6. I wrote the first product requirements document for the Nexus line, and then did a lot of intellectual property development and patent work at Cisco and at Arista as well on things you probably use. Probably, honestly, the funniest thing is most of them are like absolutely, like, I shouldn't say this, but like BS patents, because the company gave you a bonus for writing it. So you're like, wow, I could get a new car if I do 10 of these. Let's go do 10 of these. So the one that's probably the coolest was the method to backhaul from wireless access points all of the communications so that you could roam from one AP to another without dropping your connection. And that's probably the coolest one because it's really probably the most used thing. Although I'm not even a wireless guy, but like, why don't we do a multi-point GRE tunneling? Yes, it made sense.
Yeah, some things in technology are just so painfully obvious. You wonder why are they, bothering to even, patent this sort of stuff. But a while ago, I read an article.
Those are the best ones, by the way.
Yes, they are the best ones because they're the ones that have the most impact in the end of the day. But, I read somewhere that they're very popular. Patents are very popular with big companies because they can use them to defend a market position. So if somebody wants to encroach on them, they can use patents to beat away a competitor. And for small companies, it's very useful to have patents because they're an asset that can be sold. So,
yes.
So if you're a venture capitalist and you're funding a startup and you can get a patent, that patent can be sold off with a little, can be bundled up into some accumulated package and sold off to one of these patent portfolio companies and actually realize real cash.
Potentially. Now, that's almost in that last scenario, the worst case scenario, right? Because that means the business model didn't work, but there's some IP left behind it in a fire sale you can get some amount of liquidity for.
So
it's not really the outcome you're looking for in venture capital, but I think on the VC side, we always looked more at, are the patents novel? Are they defendable? And by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office or the international offices approving it, what it's really saying is this company has something novel, and it's a reinforcement of that novelty of the company's intellectual developments.
Yes, exactly. So that they've developed something and it reinforces that they've got a unique position. But yes. I think for venture capitalists, you know, selling off a patent is actually clean money. You don't have to do a whole lot of work. You bundle it up with a bunch of other patents. You know, we just offer it on an open market and away it goes. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't require much to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand. That's usually the last thing, right? Because the company's done well.
Well, I've come to the realization that actually venture capitalists are less concerned about a company doing well as finding out that one company in 20 does well, because that one company is going to be 100 times the investment, and 19 failures is perfectly acceptable.
Oh, failure is the norm, right? There's going to be a lot of companies that don't fail. And I think one thing to think about is like what market, right? So in consumer, what you're describing is, oh my gosh, it might be 1 in 20 does okay and 1 in 100 is a breakout, you know, through the roof success that funds the other 90, right? I mean, that might be the normal in consumer. In growth capital, it's a little bit different, right? You're looking at it already a successful business and you're giving it some money to expand its market. This is much more like you're a regional player and somebody's capitalizing you to expand. Similarly with internationals. The one that's a little different in model is, you know, enterprise technology. And this is where the failure rates are lower, the stakes are higher. You're going into something that should be a real business. If you're doing a semiconductor investment today, you know, as a VC, you're not doing a semiconductor investment thinking that 19 are going to fail and one succeed.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
You cannot. Not afford to do that.
So what you're saying there is there are investment portfolios or VC funded investment portfolios, which might be a bunch of teenagers, you know, sharing a six to a room, desperately trying to work out how to make PHP and MySQL work before the funding runs out. And 19 out of 20, that's the Y Combinator model, as I think of it.
And look at those as the most recent wave of Web 2.0 or whatever people want to call it. There's two different variants of tech companies that, you know, you've generally seen there. One is, I'll call it broadly consumer, but it is somebody building an application that runs on top of some other computing platform. Yeah. For instance, a lot of mobile application development today depends upon the iPhone and Android as development platforms. They depend on the functionality delivered by that platform, the ubiquity of that platform. It really lowers the barrier to entry. Similarly, Amazon, right? I'm depending on Amazon infrastructure as a service. So like one of my friends runs a company, he's got like 12 to 15 employees. They're almost all developers. I think there's like one administrative person, and they develop to the iPhone and Android and a website that runs on Amazon and an entire backend that runs on Amazon. They have no servers. They have, you know, the development is exactly as you're describing it. I developed the mobile application and some PHP and JavaScript, and off they go. Now contrast that to your sort of, you know, I used to always like to think more hardcore technology company, where you're writing Verilog, building a chip, or where you're, you know, like Cloudera, Arista, you know, look at a...
Well, I mean, those companies are radically different because a lot of those...
they're building the platform.
Yeah, it's not only the platform, but a lot of those, you actually have to buy assets to make that work. Like if you're running in Verilog, there's no open source compiler for Verilog. You have to go and buy a license from a company that has a Verilog compiler, right?
Correct.
And if you want to build an FPGA, you know, running those Verilog scripts or use an off-the-shelf FPGA, you've still got to have an FPGA simulator, and that's not an open source. You can't just go and download that from GitHub.
The barriers to entry are much higher. At a big level statement, it costs more, and the availability of people is lower, and the barrier to entry is higher.
Yes, they have to have a certain amount of money to make that get off the ground.
Now they're more expensive.
They're more expensive, but they're also less likely to fail. So what I'm trying to draw out here is the difference between an infrastructure startup and some kid writing a game in his weekends. There's a massive difference here, right? And the chances of an infrastructure startup getting away, like getting a product out the door and delivering value to customers and, you know, being around for years and years is dramatically different to the startup market that's elsewhere.
Well, and the big thing on, you know, an enterprise startup, right? A platform development infrastructure, whether it's software or infrastructure, if it's like business to business focused kind of thing, you start with, do you have product market fit, right? Am I building something that there's actually an audience for who will not just take it and go, wow, cool product, Doug, but will take it and go, cool product, I'll pay you for it. Mm. And I will repeatably pay you for it.
Yeah. Right? I'm not just going to have ads in my network monitoring console.
Right. I'm not going to do it once because you're my friend.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it once and then go, wow, this is great. I need to spend more and do this again. That's a very simple but relatively legitimate test on product market fit. And then companies go through that question of, you know, and by the way, it's usually a tumultuous phase for companies identifying and nailing product market fit. Then you go from there, especially if it's a new market entrance and new market creation. Then you go from there to the next phase, which is how do I scale my business? Do I hire salespeople? Where do I hire them? What type of selling motion do we have? It's an entirely interesting set of challenges. I've seen companies overinvest in sales, hire too many too early when they had not nailed product market fit. This causes problems. It usually results in the termination of people. The problem of terminating salespeople, if you're an engineering-led company, salespeople tend to be the most charismatic people in your entire business.
Yes, so that's true. People, well, for a startup, certainly that's true, because quite often you've got a certain type of person who
They're generally very high EQ, right? Very high emotional connectivity, charismatic. People like them. They talk to everybody in the company. So if they're not successful, everybody in the company quickly determines, oh gosh, are we not successful? Does our company have a problem? And it becomes a real challenge for the company to work through if you've scaled sales, have not nailed product market fit, and the salespeople are either not successful because they're selling the wrong thing, they're selling it the wrong way, the product doesn't work, the customers just simply don't like it, right? And so these become a whole host of challenges. I've seen now many, many enterprise technology companies, and a lot of them go through different phases like this.
Yeah. Well, it's a very difficult thing. Like, I'm sort of getting a view that many companies are using salespeople and marketing to overcome the fact that their product is faulty. So what I mean by that is there are products out there like software-defined WAN, which is currently all the rage in the infrastructure community, pretty much sells itself because it's so easy to understand. It's very easy for vendors to package it up into a comprehensible view, and it actually solves a problem that everybody has. And the cost of selling these SD-WAN solutions is actually very low.
Right. Whereas SD-WAN has a very natural product market fit, right? There had not been, when's the last time before that we saw, meaningful, significant sea change type of R&D in WAN architecture? The shift to MPLS?
Well, MPLS wasn't even an innovation or a significant transition. It was like, we can't go to IPv6 because we haven't got enough TCAM space, so let's use VLAN tags, except make them routable VLAN tags.
I viewed it more as an evolution from frame relay myself.
Yeah, I would go with that, yeah.
Right. It took us from a hub and spoke architecture to the ability to have a physical hub and spoke, but have a peer-to-peer, you know, connectivity and have these a common network core that everybody worked over. But that to me was like the last big sea change, infrastructure change in WANs. Sure, things got faster. Sure, things went from T1s to T3s to Ethernet. Sure, things went from Sonnet and stuff like that to Ethernet. But architectural change? Probably not since MPLS. And I did my first decent MPLS network in 98.
Yeah. Back when it was called tag switching.
Yes, it was. It was actually the first interconnection of Cisco and Nortel.
Yes. Yeah, I guess my point was about software-defined WAN isn't to say that, you know, software-defined WAN. But I wonder if part of what we have today is this focus on things like proof of concepts and salespeople burning shoe leather and airline seats and rented cars out, getting onto people's premises to try and convince them that this product has value. I'm increasingly of the view that this is not a viable way for us to continue, right? we need to be able to buy products directly off the internet. I mean, the cost of doing business through vendors to distributors to resellers to customers is vast. I mean, look at Cisco's results. 20% of their internal costs is sales and marketing. That's a vast amount of money being wasted when you could look at what Amazon's done to retail and said, why are you shipping all this stuff? Why don't you just buy it directly from the warehouse? Why don't you shorten the and cut out the middleman? And part of the problem here is that people will tell you, oh, but, you know, enterprise products are complicated or, you know, it's too soon, or people don't understand what's going wrong. I mean, why haven't we overcome this? Why isn't the industry collapsing around shortening the sales cycle and making it easier to buy instead of making ever more complicated products with worse licensing schemes and having to ship it from some distributor in your country instead of just ordering it from an online warehouse?
You know, I think you have an opinion here, Greg.
Well, I just was asking a question. No, I mean, do you know what I mean?
I think
the question's valid, right? The question is very loaded, right? And yes, it's fair to say that many customers don't have the skills. I mean, the flip side of this is that customers simply don't have the skills to know what they're buying.
You know, we had started the conversation with a bit about SDN, and you know, one of the things that, you know, I've kind of always felt it's kind of in line with this. It's somewhat adjacent, but I think you'll see them dovetail here. Is that in software development, and frankly, I really largely believe in IT, the developer has won the architectural decision, right? It's shifted from IT to the developer. DevOps is driving the architectural deployments for the enterprise. I mean, I just watched it a year or so ago at a Fortune 100 insurance company where the infrastructure team's going, we have to deploy a private cloud. And I'm like, well, okay, tell me what your requirements are. And the guy who gets on the phone is not an infrastructure guy. He's the developer.
Yeah.
And his requirements were, you know, I'm going to be doing containers. I'm going to be doing VMs. We're going to be spinning things up. We're going to move them everywhere. This wasn't what the network team wanted to do. This wasn't even what the server infrastructure team wanted to do. The entire requirements were being passed from the development organization to the infrastructure team to build what they wanted. Yeah. And if you look at, I mean, too often we've seen this conversation happen, which
is... Hang on. That's not new. So... Five years ago, I would have sat down with SAP or Oracle or, you know, whichever company had packaged up the product, and they would tell me what their requirements were, and I would build the infrastructure that they needed.
What's new is that I used to go to IT to get my app developed. And now, I mean, I just watched it this last week. You get the kids you were describing earlier. The business says, here's a group of developers who can build this application for me in 30 to 60 days. Or I can go to IT and with the licensed frameworks they have, and they'll tell me it's going to take 18 months. And we know it's going to take longer than that anyway. So they go to the kids. The kids build the, and pedantically saying kids. It's a more aggressive developer with a more aggressive model. We'll develop a cloud-native architecture in most cases now.
Yes.
Deliver in 30 days, deliver in 60 days. And the business is being told, you know, the infrastructure team, the old school IT team, deal with it, figure it out.
Yeah.
They solved a business problem. You were dealing with your process.
Yeah. But that's the same. My experience of working in customer sites is exactly the same as what you described, in that I would suddenly, the accounting department would turn up and say, yes, we've just bought SAP accounting. And it's going to be deployed. And we'd be going like, oh, did you think to get us involved? Oh, no, we just bought it. And that's what developers are doing today. I don't see a whole lot of difference between 5 years ago buying Oracle HR, and HR comes down to us and says, oh, no, we've done a year's deal, that, you know, we've done a year's work on this and we're just ready to go now.
The difference is velocity.
Yes, the difference is velocity. But what I'm saying is the process hasn't changed under DevOps. It's the same thing. DevOps is still doing the same thing to infrastructure that SAP and Oracle were doing to infrastructure over the last 20 years.
Yeah, except SAP and Oracle take a year to 3 years to deploy.
Yeah.
And if the application with a cloud-native model not only takes 30 to 60 days to develop, but then the way that runs on the infrastructure is spinning up new workloads that might have a life cycle of seconds as opposed to years, right? that, I mean, when we went from bare metal, your Oracle SAP world, just to VMs, I mean, how long did Oracle push back on VMs? A decade?
Oh, it's still pushing back.
Okay. Right. You know. So, and yet you went from one workload per host to 20. Hmm. And almost every switch built from 2005 earlier would die under 20 VMs running per host. It has no ability whatsoever to deal with mobile workloads, right? A live migration. So we had to go build as an industry yet another overlay technology or a large flat layer two. And we saw all this infrastructure churn trying to figure out how to deal with VMs over the last decade. Hmm. Now we go to containers, right? Oh my gosh, containers. Containers are the coolest thing. And gosh knows they're hot, they're cool, they're neat, right? Mm-hmm. Yet I see people doing 300 plus IP addresses per host with ephemeral IP addressing where the workload lasts sometimes for seconds. Mm-hmm. Yet we have eventual consistency models we've historically deployed in routing that might take longer than the life cycle of the workload to converge the availability of that workload globally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so my biggest worry is that is the velocity we're moving towards, right? The completely real-time, fluid, amorphous developers controlling the infrastructure because they're using Kubernetes, which is then going to push and synchronize IP addressing and MAC addressing and workload placement and container spin up all into a common framework that the developer can bluntly ignore, right? Yes. They set it once and then don't worry about it. Yeah. And that don't worrying about it means that me as an infrastructure guy has to be able to handle all of the possibilities of what they could do when they don't care about the infrastructure. This scares the crap out of me because, I mean, just very simply, one quick question.
Yeah.
Is my routing protocol, and not just like my vendor's implementation, I use Cisco, I use Juniper, I use Arista, is the routing protocol itself going to be able to handle the density of addressing and the ephemeral nature of the workloads, the speed and velocity of change? I don't know the answer, but I also, worse, don't know anybody who is testing the thesis.
I've spoken to people who extensively use containers, and they have real problems. They started off with bare metal, and mm-hmm. the first thing that happened was they blew out the TCAMs in their top-of-rack switches.
Absolutely.
So their TCAMs in the top-of-rack switches are only 16,000. And like you said, 300 IPs per host is not at all unusual in a moderate to heavy use of containers. Nope. So, you know, if you've got a VLAN, if you've made a mistake and got a VLAN extending, let's say you've got 40 hosts on a top of rack switch, you've got 300 per, that's 12,000 on one top of rack. If you extend that VLAN to another one next door, now you've got 24,000, you know, and boom.
You got
just,
it.
Right. Yeah. That's just one example. Right. Now, the second one is
welcome to the world of flooding. Right.
So, we can't do VLANs, but hang on. I've got 12,000 out of 16,000 TCAM entries burned just for MAC addresses and IP addresses. You know, what am I going to do now? What am I going to? Well, I'll start layer threeing them, but you've still got entries sitting in the telecam, blah, blah, blah. So, I think that a whole overlay networking discussion is over. I don't think there's any doubt that overlays over the top of a, you know, a static underlay that has completely different requirements. It's slow to converge. It's slow to change. It's going to be high speed, low value add because the overlay networks over the top are going to be where the value is.
Well, the question becomes, you know, and I mean, there's a wonderful point for overlays, but if you also look at the other way to solve this is non-overlay, right? Which is, if I just simply route on the host and advertise a /23 out per host on all the DV uplinks, I don't need an overlay.
No. So what you're doing is what I call pre-automation. You're automating by pre-automating everything, by making nothing, allocating resources so nothing needs changing. However, that assumes that a /23 or 512 addresses per host is enough. Arguably not so, right?
I mean, I said it /23. You could do a /22 and give yourself 2x the headroom.
That's right. But even so, right now, all of a sudden, you're starting to have, if you're inside an existing organization, you might have already burned most of your 10-dot these days with a brand. You know, if you've got 5,000 branch nodes, each one burning a /24 or a /20 up to a /22, you might not have too many slash, you know, out of your 10 slash, you might not have much left. I know that for true.
You should have 65,536 available.
Yes, but a lot of them have been, it's not unusual to see like 30, 40,000 of them burned. So,
possible.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, like, I mean, if I go back to, you know, one of the things I've looked at is like what, you know, Google, who obviously has spent a little bit of time on Kubernetes, so they're actually promoting the non-overlay model as the architecture they've been implementing.
Mm.
And I think a lot of it has to do with increased complexity of the infrastructure, right? Mm. Because it kind of alludes to the other sort of major theme and thesis I've come to believing, which, I mean, sort of first off, simplicity tends to win, right? The more simple you can make something, the more elegant you can make something, great. But I have a fundamental belief that we've seen a significant skills gap emerge and get exacerbated in networking and in IT more broadly, but specifically networking over the past 5 to 7 years. And by a skills gap, I mean, there's almost two classes of people. And I really hate to be like so trite about this or so definitive, but one class is the class of guy I am. I'm a keyboard guy. I know the CLI. If you said, Doug, configure the switch or router, I would walk on, I would type conf T, right? And I would interface this. I would type some show commands to figure out what I'm doing. I would SSH into it. You know what I mean? It's like, that's the world I grew up on. I'm going to argue that's the world that 99% of the network infrastructure operators know, right? It's this world of, I'm this, what's, and frankly, in most organizations, you know, if I'm the IT, if I'm the network guy in a mid-sized enterprise where I might be the network guy, my familiarity with a command line interpreter dictates and is the single biggest factor in dictating vendor selection, right? If I know Cisco, the likelihood that even if I got a better commercial deal from Juniper, the likelihood I'm going to choose Juniper because of my lack of familiarity with it is significantly minimized. Now, but there's another class of guy out there. Call them a network programmer. Call them a infrastructure developer. I don't care. But when you go to a very large web scale shop, an Amazon, a Google, an Azure, their network guys in most cases aren't even authorized to even go issue a CLI command on a switch. Nobody touches their infrastructure with a CLI. They add new systems, they change architectures, they deploy, they do adds, moves, changes, they roll out, they roll back. Yet no human is touching a command line, and in most cases, no machine's touching a command line.
They're pulling an API off the unit, whatever the unit might be.
They've abstracted that infrastructure from the policy that they're rolling out.
Well, I mean, I've seen a distinct, I think it's a bit more fundamental than that. While I don't disagree with your characterization that there's console jockeys and API jockeys, right? That's fine. What I also think we've seen is that a lot of the senior talent in networking has actually left networking and gone to become API jockeys or left the industry completely, gone off to virtualization because they got bored. I mean, how many years can you futz around with BGP before it becomes tedious?
At least 25, trust me.
Yeah. I know, right? I know. Part of the reason I'm doing this is because I got incredibly bored with BGP and OSPF and, you know, just doing the same old, same things that I've done for 20 plus years. And I do wonder, where does the next generation of skills come from? Like a lot of customers, and here's an observation that I've made on the show many times, and tell me what your perspective is. Here's my hypothesis. The hypothesis is that a lot of people who work in IT infrastructure got there via some path where they started at the bottom and they came up through the top. Many of them don't have any foundation in technology. They don't have any computer science skills. A very large number, maybe more than 50%, have never cut a program in their life. That's led to a lack of skills in the customer. Customers don't even understand the concept of using APIs or software to drive infrastructure because that's nothing that they've ever experienced or learned. There's a massive skills gap inside of enterprise infrastructure teams.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, look at, we're seeing in the large financials, which used to be like the best place to go as a network guy, we're seeing salary compression. We're seeing certainly bonuses go down. Yet the highest paid infrastructure job I could probably get today, right, as like an individual contributor network guy, would be to go and learn Python or Go and C and go work for one of the large web scale shops. Now, here's the fundamental problem I run into, though, is, you know, Google, Amazon, Azure, the network programmer, the infrastructure developer interacts with a system, and that system interacts with the machines. This system takes the intent I have, turns it into the configuration and API calls that are going to go into the machine, or into the switch, the router, whatever it is I'm configuring. Those systems, that network middleware system that they use, isn't commercially available. Like, I can't pick up the phone. I can't go to GitHub and download it and say, hey, I'd like to deploy a full network administration, operations, NCM plus provisioning system. What do I buy? And because these are all homegrown, in-house developed, they've gotten a lot better in the last 5 years because the vendors moved to APIs from CLI, or moved, added APIs in addition to CLI, I should accurately say. It's made those systems far more effective. But to me, it becomes what SDN really was meant to be. Because if you think of, you know, when SDN started, it was a great term, loved it. You had two outshoots of it. One was network virtualization, the creation of the overlay network. That really wasn't network virtualization. It was transport virtualization. It's yet another tagging format, right? We threw another, we took a packet and shoved in another packet. We've been doing this for 20 years as well, right? I mean, that's GRE. That's IP and IP tunneling. That was available in a Cisco 2500 in 10.3, right? So is it really that creative? It was a dynamically generated tunnel. That was cooler, but we had DMVPN too. So, you know, just looking at it abstractly, I'm not that blown away that like VXLAN was the second coming. No. It was a nice technology. It helped solve some problems. Cool.
I think the thing that made VXLAN innovative or exciting in people's eyes was that it really was the best transition we've had in data center networking in 25 years. Data center networking in 25 years.
I would say it actually was solving a problem, right? It solved the problem of, I need to move, because of virtualization, a VM from host one to host two and keep it alive.
Yes.
And VXLAN was a method that let me do that without breaking everything else I may have had deployed, i.e., you know, that one switch that sat in the middle that I just can't get rid of, but darn it, it didn't need to know about VXLAN. It just needed to forward a packet. It did just fine. Right. So I could, the two switches in the leaves could have the visibility, or the VM in a leaf switch could have the visibility, and I could do what I needed to do. And it didn't break everything. It didn't require galactic reformation. So it was an incremental technology where I needed to be, yet it solved a big ticket problem that it was intended to solve. But by the way, the other core technology, right? But let's be clear, that's transport virtualization. It didn't virtualize my entire network. Right, it's not like a true network hypervisor, right? That abstracted my intentions and policies from all the underlying infrastructure. That didn't care whether it was Cisco or Juniper or Arista or, you know, Cumulus or Mellanox. It didn't care. That would be like a network hypervisor, which would be analogous to network virtualization. It didn't do that.
So you're saying that what ESX did as a hypervisor for the server operating system, overlays still didn't for networks? You think that's not a viable comparison?
I don't think that's a viable comparison at all.
We are taking a short break from the show to talk about one of today's sponsors, Micronics Training. I can talk about Micronics not just because they are a sponsor, but because I am a Micronics customer. In fact, I have attended multiple CCIE routing and switching boot camps with Micronics over the years with instructor Narbik Kacharians. One boot camp was just before I passed my CCI routing and switching lab back in 2008, and the most recent one was in the fall of 2015. Micronics boot camps are the real deal. You get detailed workbooks that show you not only what to do, but also the most important part of networking, verifying that what you've configured is working right. You also get live lectures from top-notch instructors. For example, Narvik's lectures are legendary among those of us that have sat in them. He wastes no words while still clearly explaining topics that might have frustrated you before. And you will not see a PowerPoint. It is all whiteboard. It's sort of like being Neo in the Matrix. You leave the lecture feeling like network foo was uploaded directly to your brain. These boot camps aren't just workbooks and lecture, though. You also get time to work on equipment configuration with even more labs designed to teach specific concepts. These boot camps are, if I'm honest, really tough, because if you do everything that's expected of you, your boot camp days will be some of the longest, but most rewarding, 5 or 10 days that you can spend. Which reminds me, Micronix offers several CCIE-level boot camps, including routing and switching, security, data center, and service provider. Some of them are 5 days, some of them are 10 days, and if you're not working on a CCIE certification, Micronix offers instruction in several other courses, including CCNA, CCNP, DCICN, CCDE, and more. So to learn from the best, head over to MicronixTraining.com. Micronix is an authorized Cisco Learning Partner, and they accept Cisco Learning Credits. One more time, that's MicronixTraining.com. And please, when you sign up for a course or a boot camp, let them know that Packet Pushers sent you.
What overlays did for networks is transport virtualization.
Yes. So what would be network virtualization? So let's drill into that a little bit. What would network virtualization be then? Disaggregation of the operating system from the hardware? Would it be NFV, hosting multiple network functions in a single device and using SDN to path between them? Would it be, or what?
Well, those are two interesting things. I don't think those are – no, NFV to me is SDN by a very pure definition, right? I always liked Martin Casado's definition of SDN, which is take a function that ran in hardware and now run it completely in software, right? That's a really purist, but I believe accurate, very accurate definition of SDN, of software-defined anything, right? And NFV, taking a function, load balancing, firewalling, VPN, and bringing those functions to a set of VMs or containers, a set of processes that all run in software, I really like. And by the way, when I think of like what the evolution of the edge router should be, personally, I think the evolved edge router should be like a 2 to 4 rack unit box with big buffers, a reasonable amount of ports, large tables, but also a services shelf. And a services shelf that hangs off the side that has a mix of NPUs and x86 that spins up n number of containers per tenant so that you as a tenant get, your bandwidth. And if you want to upgrade, if the carrier wants to upgrade services for you, they can. And they can upgrade your services without impacting mine because my services are running on version 4 of these containers and you're on version 6. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
But I would love to see that type of service shelf accelerated platform sitting next to and being peering logically with the transport box, right?
I subscribe to that vision. I can understand that. So, a box, an x86, has many hundreds of 100 gig interfaces in it or breakouts.
Probably 4 of them or something.
Whatever it is. And in there is VMs and containers that are being used to deliver services, malware scanning, accounting packages, accounting systems collecting data, traffic analysis, as well as firewalling, IDS, IPS. There's a whole range of things we can do.
All those things we historically called appliances.
That's right. Now, that's step one. What I also believe is I don't believe that telcos or carriers will ever be able to do that, at least not for the next 20 to 30 years, which, as far as I'm concerned, is forever, right? Because I'll be dead by the time that's a problem. And the reason being is that any time you offer complicated edge services at scale, the system breaks down. Telcos are functionally incapable of focusing per customer. They focus, because they have so many endpoints and so many people and so much bandwidth and so many, POPs and presences and cables in the ground, it's just impossible for them to, as a business, not as a technology, it's not a technology problem, it's a business problem, to work out how do we create services for customers and deliver them at a point.
Well, back to automation, right? If there was to exist an automation system that could understand the dependency tree between the different container instances I was using. And so if me as a customer goes in and says, without touching a customer service person without touching a provisioning person, a network planning person, and I'm able to go, oh, I'd like to add a DDoS prevention capability to my circuits. Click go. Hmm. Right, just like today, I can do exactly what I've described in the cable world. I can get a different channel package delivered to my house than you. Hmm. I can add the tennis channel.
Yes.
And you could add the rugby channel, right? And so you're getting a different set of services delivered to your home that I'm getting delivered to mine. And
yeah, I agree with that, right? So in theory, that's all correct, right? In terms of a $200 billion a year company being able to package that up and not get distorted by the business process. So, you know, oh, we need to have content that appeals to 500 million people. Oh, we'll go and do a deal with Disney. Oh, Disney now says you can only have this software under these conditions. Well, we're not going to be able to be like Netflix and build our own content engine, you know, start building our own content that our customers want to watch. We'll have to take those conditions. And now all of a sudden you've got cable, 350 channels, of which none of it's what you want to watch. I mean, I'm just using that as an exaggeration, but the point is that
I don't think it's a fair comparison, Greg. Hmm. I can go today and get the pure cheapest basic cable package. Mm-hmm. And then in many cases, pay for just the channels I want to add. I'm doing that today. Mm. But by the way, why can I do that today on a scale of hundreds of millions of clients for my MSO? Is because there's an automated provisioning system there. I can add a new channel to my package from my remote control sitting in my living room talking to nobody and have it available in about 3 seconds. That works today. It's real today. It's delivered to my house today.
Well, but not at scale. You're one of the very few customers who on, like, for example, here in the UK, I have
a Virgin. They have over 100 million customers. That's scale.
But they're not giving me, I don't have the ability to add and delete services from my, I have to ring them up and argue with them for 45 minutes.
Okay. Could we make the statement here that a cable operator who is invested in an automated infrastructure is able to deliver me a service level that lets me add and remove services very quickly in seconds from my remote control sitting on my fat ass in the living room. You, on the other hand, are currently operating with a cable operator mm-hmm. who cannot do that, who requires you to pick the phone up and get off your fat ass to grab the phone and make that call. So both of us on our fat asses have a different experience because
my point is
one provider's invested in automation, the other hasn't.
Just because one provider has, and maybe a small-scale provider, is your provider a large-scale provider or a small one?
The largest scale in the U.S.
Right. So why is that not rolled out to everybody in the U.S.? Do they have to replace the hardware? Or do they have to?
No. I'm connected to the largest provider in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So the largest provider in the U.S. offers this today.
Then, you know, I can accept that. I mean, I said to you, it's technology. It's not a technology problem. It's a business problem. The flexibility flowing down to customers.
Yeah. But let's come back to it. Mm. I'm absolutely willing to bet that the automation tool that my large carrier built that gives me this capability does not exist in the midsize carrier, the regional carrier, because it is not commercially available. I'm almost 100% willing to bet they had to build this tool themselves. Mm-hmm. And just like Google's built their provisioning tool themselves, mm-hmm. Amazon built theirs, Azure built theirs. When I talk about the skills gap of people and then the split of, you know, SDN went to network virtualization or transport virtualization and OpenFlow was the other thrust. Mm-hmm. The gap, the big gap that I would love to see closed is how do we build a commercially available, cost-effective network operations system? Well, what if we could build a self-operating network, Greg? Mm. What if we could build a network that had a tool that probably ran distributed that let you define the patterns of the network you wanted to create, deploy them, measure them, have the telemetry and the testing to know that it actually worked the way it was supposed to. Because you and I both know, because we've drawn this on a whiteboard before, I can design a network that looks, when you look at it on a whiteboard, is the stupidest looking thing you've ever seen. You know, four spine switches, one leaf switch, quad-homed into one of the spine switches.
Yep.
Right? Yet, that network will pass every single test from WhatsApp Gold, every test from every network automation and testing suite we have. It will come up and go, all green, baby. You've got great capacity. You've got great bandwidth. You've got four uplinks. You're looking golden. But the second we have a planned outage where I'm upgrading that one spine switch, I black hole a large chunk of my infrastructure.
So, or when you upgrade your top of rack, you've just shot down a whole rack of gear.
Yeah.
Let's take a break from the show today to talk about our sponsor, Op Manager from ManageEngine. Op Manager is a complete network management platform for network and server monitoring, bandwidth analysis, IP address and switch port management, configuration management, and more, all available as a single .exe file. Op Manager covers a great deal of your IT operations. We're going to mention just a couple of key features today. The first is monitoring of network health and performance. This includes the features you expect from network monitoring, including bandwidth monitoring, router and switch device monitoring, and integration with Cisco IPSLA as well as NBAR. With Op Manager, you can even build custom dashboards, allowing you to make that knock view that everybody likes, or the one with the big green light and the thumbs up, so your manager sleeps well. The second feature we'll mention today is Op Manager's ability to handle flow data in the Bandwidth Manager tool. Many different flow formats are supported, including firewall logs, IP fix, and NetFlow, which can tell you which specific applications are consuming your bandwidth. And the cool part is when you see a problem in the Bandwidth Manager, you can jump straight to the Configuration Manager to fix it. And hey, it's multi-vendor. But you want more, okay? Op Manager can pair flow data with user metadata so that you know not only the source IP of those flows, but also the human being attached to them. This means you can do things like tweak a firewall policy with user-centric rules in reaction to the flows being seen blocking bad behavior. Op Manager, it can scale to 50,000 devices or 1 million interfaces and includes workflow automation for troubleshooting and remediation and colorized WAN links for easy performance alerting. You also get a customizable dashboard with multiple views for operators and managers, and all these features are available as a part of a single installation, which makes Op Manager easy to install and evaluate. So go to opmanager.com/packetpushers and get a free 30-day trial. And thanks to ManageEngine for being a sponsor. And now, back to the show.
So let me ask you this question. Why do we still use our legacy routing protocols? Why are vendors so hooked up on... So it looks like EVPN is going to be the overlay protocol going forward. And everybody seems
to be... It's a good
one. It's a good one, right? But it uses BGP to distribute configuration information around the network. Effectively, BGP is a distributed computing system. It's the messaging bus between the distributed computing nodes. And... in 35 years of IT, you know, computing, we've got much better distributed computing algorithms, things like Paxos, for example. Why are we still dumbing down to BGP instead of moving forward? Why doesn't the networking industry as a whole actually, like, you know, move forward?
You know, it's a good question. I don't know the alternatives enough to speak that intelligently on them. But what I can say is BGP exists. It's kind of like saying... how many enterprise applications that are still being built today are using MySQL or using SQL Server, right? Is it the best? No. Is it the most cutting edge? No. Does it work? Yes. Is it pretty reliable now? Very. Is it everywhere? Yes. Can it run on every single server they have? Yeah, pretty much assuredly.
Yeah.
So the ubiquity in mass is what keeps a technology in front of you. And, you know, when Yakov and Tony designed BGP version 4, they designed it to run the internet at a very large scale. And I think we can say pretty categorically, great job, guys. It works.
I'm not disputing that it works. What I would like to see is like what Facebook is doing with OpenR to, instead of using BGP to communicate between devices with its very limited set of features, at the end of the day, a TLV is not a very good data set, right?
No, it is not the most extensible data structure.
No,
it was the best they had at the time. Thank God we did it. But
Right. But it was making do with what you have rather than looking at the potential of what you could achieve. And so with Facebook and OpenR, they're having a go at this and saying, well, sure, why don't we use zero MQ as a messaging bus and then start to produce you know, distributed computing algorithms to shift data between devices and we could arbitrarily define the data set. So now if I've got an ECMP infrastructure, instead of using 40-year-old protocols that were invented, you know, in the 1960s, basically, on mathematical theory from the 1960s, that you've now got a true message bus communicating configuration information between the nodes that can be arbitrarily defined. That, to me, is where we should have gone and actually moved networking forward.
Maybe. I think one of the problems you're going to run into just with that thesis is that it is very similar to the analogy we started this conversation with around the old school IT developer versus the newfangled kid on the block. The new kid on the block also likes to change his tool sets every 90 to 360 days based on what's hot at the moment.
Yeah, he wants to run MongoDB because he wants a distributed database, blah, blah, blah. Yep.
You got it. And God help us if I had a network routing protocol based on Mongo. Right? I would be afraid for my data structure. So there is a set of the routing protocols themselves were designed at that time. One of the key tenets of those designs was to be not only standardizable, but also computationally unintensive, right? We dealt with much smaller CPU and memory capacities back 20 years ago, 30 years ago, than we deal with today. Yeah. So lightweight was a core attribute of these routing protocols. What we've actually seen, if you think about it, is BGP used to be BGP in the core. Don't, it's too complex. Don't mess with it anywhere. Yeah. And nowadays, I watch BGP running out of a host to advertise the /22/23 on the host to the top of rack switch, which uses BGP to connect to the spine. And, we've built IGP-less networks, right? Large scale, 10,000
In those cases, BGP is significantly adapted from what it, from the WAN version. Its time is a different and its convergence times are much more advanced and it burns a lot more CPU and memory than the older versions, than historically. So,
sure.
Yeah, but my point remains is that I agree with you. MySQL is an excellent thing. It's like saying petrol-powered cars. There's petrol everywhere. You can never have electric cars because there's no electricity on the highway. And yet, pretty shortly after we started having electric cars, guess what? All of those problems got solved. But
It took one company to solve it, right? I mean, the one company came out and did, Tesla, right? Built the Tesla. Shook the market up, took the investment upon themselves to put the supercharging stations out there, which are proprietary, but better performing than anything else in the market.
Well, they had to be proprietary because no one else was building them. So inherently, they're not in proprietary because, Cisco prevent competitors from taking me out.
No. The supercharger is proprietary. It actually has almost the equivalent of a key exchange mechanism to make sure the receiving node is an authorized Tesla.
He's made attempts to release that, though. I think Tesla is a little less committed to closed than most people think.
Well, I think they did it, again, for the reason of let's create some differentiation to get our product out there. Mm. And let's make our product, more than anything, let's give a great experience on driving and using a Tesla to our owners so that we get more owners. And as they get more mass, you're right, I don't think they're wed to it long term. Mm. But, you will note the new Model 3 does not have supercharger support for All right, so they'll be monetizing it with the Model 3. I'm willing to bet in that time frame they will try to achieve a greater density
That Elon Musk will sell off the supercharger network to some institutional investor.
That would be cool. I wish Brocade would do the same thing.
That makes more sense to me. I mean, it just doesn't. So let's talk about SDN as a movement. So are we, in your view, are we getting it right or are we getting it wrong? If we're going, and why?
So I know this is going to disagree with you, which always makes for a fun show, but is also probably why we get along. Because, who wants a yes guy in their life?
Exactly. Boring.
So I think, right.
That's what vendors are for. Yes, sir, we can do that. Yes, but what are you going to do? We can do whatever you want. We can do all of it. The answer is yes. Sign here, 5 copies.
Especially if you have a services business, right?
That's right,
sign here in triplicate, exactly.
That's right.
It's DocuSign now, but that's cool. I like DocuSign. Yeah. So by the way, the first thing I think we're gonna see is there'll be a set of companies that look towards, and let's put all this under an SDN umbrella and let's not debate semantics, but I think you'll see a set of companies move towards creating policy frameworks frameworks that work for containers, right? Because right now, with the lack of bound IP addressing, most of the ways we've historically bound policy to transport networks, right, to put an inline device that knew your IP or your DNS and bound policy to you, will fundamentally break in a containerized model. So there needs to be a new policy framework that can create policies and distribute policies to containers, but by the way, coordinate those policies with transport devices, bare metal hosts, as well as VMs, right? So the whoever can nail this broadly in a scalable fashion that subscribes to at least some reasonable set of open standards, frankly, or at least open source to make people feel happy that they're not doing a complete proprietary lock-in model, will probably do well. So, you know, prognostication, I think that's a movement that needs to happen. And it's being around container awareness. The second
thing.
So
we do
thing,
have some of that. We do have companies like.
There are.
You know, look, got Apstra is just one that's just emerged. Glue Network has sort of an intent driven model.
That they're doing something different than container policy, though.
Yes. Right. But, I mean, there's no reason that their current momentum can't carry them in that direction if customers draw them there.
Looking at everything they've written, that's not, you use intent driven, that's not their intent. Right. But think of it this way. I mean, let's look at that as probably more Illumio, probably more, got Tigera, right? The Metaswitch spin out of Calico, right? Kind of they're, so again, those types of space, a VArmor, right? Again, its policy is core to this construct, right? And so they have to have a policy engine, and it's how can they deploy that policy to multiple devices? And
well, NewArch does that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there
but
you go.
Those are, I mean, there's a big difference here. Just to separate this, the companies that you listed are very much in adjacent to networking. They're not networking companies. NewArch is, but the other ones aren't. So Illumio is taking their policy template and applying it to security to drive first stage sales.
Visibility and security, absolutely. But again, policy, right? And again, we're talking about policy, and applying policy to containers is the problem. And so will that be solved through a switch? Probably not.
No, it won't be on a switch. It can't be an hardware.
Right. So it's probably going to be a software, core software capability that solves this problem. And who solves it best will be the person who integrates it with switches, with firewalls, with virtualization, and with containers.
Yeah, Kubernetes and
Kubernetes Mesos and Docker, right? Yeah. So again, so take that as sort of bucket tranche one, right? The next, and you know, you had mentioned Apstra. I think there's a couple others that are interesting in the space. I think there's a product Spinnaker, which is kind of neat as well, which is the space for an intent-driven. Okay, so this to me is, how do I make SDN for like the mid-market masses and address the skills gap that's been emerging in IT? And the concept is, you know, what is that network middleware component? How do I, one, break that vendor-specific CLI-bound, you know, my knowledge is Cisco CLI, so I only buy Cisco. How do you break that cycle? Right, to give better freedom of choice to the business, frankly, even just better commercial operations to run reverse auctions if they want, you know, to have three people really, truly competitively bid for their business. How do you do that? Also, the concept of intent, right? It's something I remember sketching out years ago when I was at Arista and writing up and debating with Andy and Ken, and it was really fun. And it was like three lines of CLI you could write that would say, like, my network is a layer three leaf spine, my node role is a leaf, and my uplink connectivity pattern should be 4 10-gig uplinks to 4 different switches, right? So like 10 by 10 by 10 by 10. And if you wrote that, I mean, just simply those three lines, I now have the framework to test the actual combination of the physical cabling plus the stated configuration. Does it achieve that outcome? And this was, I mean, hacky because, like, you know, again, like I said, most of the intellectual property I've developed is BS over my lifetime. So it was, you know, very poorly thought through and hacky, but it was designed to solve a problem. And the problem was, how do I state what I want my network to do? And like a good software developer does, how do I write my test plan How do I automate my test plan? And then how do I have my automated test plan run against the code I wrote to say, does the code I wrote achieve the intent I wanted for my functional spec and pass my test plan? Mm-hmm. And if it does, thumbs up, commit it, move it to top of tree. But if it doesn't, oh gosh, what is failing? So how do I take that same model of define intent, deploy intent, and then in a closed loop testing model, make sure, did it work?
Define intent, test intent for sanity, deploy it, and then test that it worked after you deployed it. So to make sure there's
test the exact test the deployed configuration. Is it working for me? But
but
can't
in an
do
era of traceroute as our sole track, ping and traceroute as our sole testing tool, we still don't have the instrumentation to do serious testing of actual networks.
You know, the funny thing is, when we talk about the shift to APIs, if you look at a lot of the things that the vendors have had to put into those APIs for, again, the web scale customers, the core constructs are there. Mm-hmm. The ability to load an agent into a switch. I mean, could I load a 1000Eyes agent into a switch?
Mm-hmm. Sure. You can. Yeah.
Yeah. Can I test uplinks and can I test buffers? Can I test my QoS policies? Can I test my pathing? Yeah. It's there. Core. I mean, by the way, and it wasn't 5 years ago.
It wasn't right? 2 years ago. This is something that. Right. So this to me is probably the heart of NFV for network operations, is that I can now put things inside of my network device. Now, the idea of a router as a network device, that to me is long gone. The very least you could do with a network device is route. What it should be able to do is to host a firewall, a WAN accelerator, a monitoring, an analytics instance, one that collects analytic data from the routing function and then forwards it off for analysis. But it could also start to include, monitoring agents like 1000Eyes and so forth that actually sit on top of the host and monitor the routing tables and apply, artificial/ML objects. So you wouldn't do ML at the edge of the network. That's not practical. But I think it's much more likely that you're going to have ML functions, machine learning functions going on in the cloud that says, if you see this, then that is something that you should flag, because the machine learning knows that this is, and this is a dynamically iterative, a bit like in the way with security, you subscribe to a cloud service and it says, here's the latest set of security vulnerabilities that we found across the world. And they're continually being learned out of the cloud. Well, we can take that same principle and apply that to network path operations or device monitoring operations or application response time operations. If this application response goes into this, then you should throw an alert, because over a combination of 10,000 customers, we know that that's a problem.
Well, and you're getting to the third point that is, I don't know anybody commercially doing this today. I think there's some companies that are on a starting path to this, but, achieved, it's not achieved. I love the model, and I had a great conversation this week at ONUG with some folks, and it started with drawing a mental comparison between the National Highway Transport Safety Administration, drawing an analogy between their self-driving car model of the five levels, right, starting level zero to level five, of the evolution of autonomy in car driving. And, why did we do routing protocols? You could build a perfect network with static routes.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You did routing protocols so that things would change and you wouldn't have to go program the static routes for it to change. That's the intention of routing protocols. It's to automate a function for you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it automates
I call it self-configuration rather than automation, but yes.
Yeah. But, without you doing anything, right, it will figure out a path. No, that was the intention, right?
Self-correcting, self-configuring, but not automation.
So we can survive nuclear war.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
We can debate, but if a human doesn't touch it, it's kind of automated, right? That might be the only thing it ever does, but no human has to push a button for it to converge.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Well,
there's no intelligence to it, is what I'm trying to say. It's self-determining, it's self-configuring, but it's not automation. It's only able to derive from a very limited number of inputs, a fixed output.
Of course. I would... on a purely intellectual level, debate you on automation versus intelligence, right? The one is, how many data points are you using to make a decision and automate something?
Yeah.
Automation is, I walk in the room and the lights go on, right? Now, the only input it had is I walked in the room and it had a motion sensor and the lights went on, but that is automated. The lights went on when I walked in the room.
Mm-hmm.
It's not any degree of smart automation, right? My Nest got a little bit better. It like tracks, when am I usually home, right? Let me create a thermostat model that will lower your bill but still have the house warm when you get there, right? So that was a better degree of intelligence.
Yeah.
But the only thing it automated was moving a thermostat dial.
Yes, right. And then really, now you're starting to get into it. Now you're leading into a discussion around IoT, where if I open a door 10 times, my air conditioning needs to come on to, you know, blah blah blah.
Right. Mm. But you get the point of there's a set of inputs are getting broader and broader and broader. Mm-hmm. But automation is making some change without a human involved.
Yeah.
So what if we get to, if we take that model of self-driving cars and apply that to networking? Think about this for a second. We go from I had all human to I have basic cruise control. Now, I could make the analogy that routing protocols and spanning tree and things like that are like basic cruise control. It's not even distance sensitive cruise control, but it's like, I will hold the speed for you and you can take your foot off the gas and I keep the speed, right? It might slow down when I go uphill and speed up when I go downhill, but darn it, it holds that speed. Mm. To now we've seen distance sensitive cruise controls. I have autopilot on my car now. It's lane keeping plus distance sensitive cruise control, and it does pretty good. But you still are required to watch it. I'm required for obstacle avoidance. I'm required for a car cutting me off. I'm required for it gets squirrely when it sees an off ramp. Yes. Right. So it still requires active human monitoring. Mm. That's the phase we're kind of in that period of today with networks. And what, you know, I think the goal of a network should be like, you know, Skynet like self-operation, right? I mean, that's where we should get to. And that's what we should set a target for and figure out a rational path to move forward as an industry, which means multiple vendors should figure out how do they move their systems and their infrastructure towards that rational path. There will be competition at each phase. And as there's competition, there will be learning. There will be innovation and there will be fallout. Mm. But if we do this, what we can create is a model where the operator's job is not to sit there and stare at the screen waiting for green lights to turn red and then bang away on a CLI, or you know, to watch for a system to go off and say, danger, check this out now, and then bang away on a CLI. But truly, like I feel like you and I want the same outcome, which is, can we actually have the level of intelligence, the amount of telemetry and data points in, the ability to orchestrate changes across a wide variety of systems, so the only pre-deployment of virtualization, you know, and to use your analogy there of I pre-deployed all the VLANs everywhere. Mm. The only level I have to do is, where did I physically put things and what are they physically connected to? Mm. Imagine all I have to do to build a network is be the kid with the erector set who puts a server, you know, connects the servers to the top of racks, physically connects the top of racks to the spine switches. When I want to add capacity, I put a few more top of racks in and I connect a few more ports back. When I want to upgrade capacity, I upgrade capacity and I put in more, either more ports or I take out vendor one switch, put in vendor twos, and it has 400 gig uplink, so I use it. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to change my config. I don't have to touch a CLI. I don't have to change an operating model of my infrastructure. I don't have to change a telemetry gathering system to do that. Mm. The day I could take a CAT 6500 out, replace it with a Nexus 7000, take an N7K out, replace it with a 9K, and then deploy next to that some Arista boxes, Juniper boxes, and Cumulus boxes.
And that's the same model as what we get with containers. A container is ephemeral. It should turn up, turn down, and the app should continue to run.
And
you should be able
to
lose a server. You should be able to lose a switch. You should be able to lose whatever it is, because everything's, you know, that every single device of any function, container, server, node, device node, storage node should not matter. Lose one, nothing, you know, systems change, will continue until something's.
Correct. And that to me, Greg, is true network virtualization, or in the end, with the level of automation and telemetry, a self-operating network. That's what I think we as an industry need to be moving towards.
So you think that people who build overlay networks will need to be talking to the physical underlay at some point? Would that be a fair summary?
Because your physical underlay, I mean, I made this point 5 years ago. I can go into three CLI commands and destroy your overlay and you won't know it. Mm.
So why haven't the overlay people started to pull APIs on the underlay? Is that because the people who make underlays, like there is a gulf between overlay only, you know, NSX, NewArch, PlumGrid, you know, all those, Metacura, all those overlay companies, and then the companies who build hardware-centric SDN, like Cisco's ACI and so forth, right, where they do it all in the hardware. And Juniper's got QFX, Brocade's got their switches, but where are the APIs that they're presenting so that overlay companies can use their hardware? Are they resisting the change? Is it not possible to make the change? Is it a lack of industry coherence? I mean, what's preventing that?
You know, I think there's two forces at play on this one, which is the goal of the overlay guy, or the goal of the underlay, the goal of the infrastructure-centric ones was to do it their way for themselves the best so they win and they get more switch sales, right? I mean, that's like, if I sell switches, that's my goal, sell more switches. So I'm going to make my way the best for me. If I'm doing an overlay, the goal is to support as many vendors as quickly as possible, and really not even in the middle, as many endpoints as possible. So the business interest of a Now, I'll pick on Nuage because I really like them, so I don't feel like I'm picking on them when I say this. Yeah. But like the business goal of a Nuage is to go and get on VMs, containers, and as many switching vendors, the leaf that have a VXLAN VTAP as possible. Right? Because truly, the overlay by design doesn't care about what's in the middle, right? As long as it has all the endpoints and all the edge, it doesn't care what's in the middle. Yet we know a disruption in the middle, an outage in the middle, or a misconfiguration in the middle can break the overlay. So I think it has to be a logical next step for the overlays after they've achieved density, right? The first customer requirement is make VMs be able to move from one server to another, keeping their IP address across as many things as I have. The more things you have, the more differentiated your overlay is from your peers or your competitors. So you're winning. But the next level of intelligence is going to be, okay, you've connected them all. What do you do now?
Yeah.
So
this whole policy engine sort of implies that you'll stop futzing around with the nuts and bolts and start thinking about, you know, instead of going out to your car and checking all the nuts and bolts are tight before you get in it, you just get in the car and drive it and wait for some system to tell you that the car's at fault. Is that fair analysis?
Using the car analogy, most enterprises that are in the world where they're building their own custom cars at home, maybe occasionally looking at Popular Mechanics / Network World for some and / Packet Pushers for some guidance, right? Yet the world of Google and Amazon and Facebook and Azure is a world of incredibly repeated patterns. So they're operating the Model Ts, right? Yes. They've built assembly lines where every Google rack is identical.
Okay.
Let me ask 10,000 times.
Yeah, I don't subscribe. There are things you can take from Google, but as a general rule, what Google, Amazon, Facebook, you know, and so forth are doing, you can't take down into an enterprise ID data center. There is one thing though that I think is very different for enterprise IT, which is this arrival of hyperconverged systems. So,
Google in a box.
Google in a box, right? Or Google in a rack, or a Google across three or four racks. And right. I think one of the most interesting things that might be coming out of this, and I'd be very interested to hear your take on this, is the days of specifying that my network is made of vendor A, like all my switches come from vendor. I'm a Cisco shop, or I'm a Juniper shop, or I'm a Brocade shop, and all my switches must be Brocade. I think that the thing that's going to break that isn't this, you know, what you're talking about, policy-driven template systems that do the configuration of the devices for you. What I think we'll see is I've got a hyperconverged Nutanix. I've got a hyperconverged Cisco FastStack over in the left corner because that's on that. And then over here, I've got a HPE system over there doing something. And then over here, I've got a Dell Azure Private Cloud because I want to, you know. And all of a sudden, those racks come with their own networking in it. When you get a Cisco stack, you get a Fabric Interconnect at the top, which is a Nexus switch, right? And over here, HPE is shipping their switches running Comware at the top of rack. Nutanix is going to put switches in there. Dell will be running a Dell switch. Maybe it's running Cumulus operating systems. You're not going to be able to specify that your network comes from one vendor in a land of hyperconverged. Is that fair? Is that an assumption? Like your network cannot be multi-vendor going forward because it won't be.
No, your network will inherently be multi-vendor going forward because of hyperconverged systems.
Yes, that would be right, my... Not- thesis.
I completely agree with you, right? You're going to the likelihood, the demise of the single vendor network is, I would almost say, foreordained, right? Mm. If you believe that hyperconverged systems are a easier consumption model, especially at mid-enterprise to mid-market. Now, by the way, what do they compete with? They're competing with AWS, right? Because the path I'm on is either, well, I can continue to roll my own, building a very bespoke system. Mm-hmm. I can go on-premise. If I go on-premise, hyperconverged is, for many customers, a fast path, a easy button to deploying increased capacity for on-premises systems, or I deploy it into an infrastructure as a service cloud. So, I mean, there's one thesis out there, by the way, that I really believe strongly, which is, you know, if you look at the Intel server distribution, like 40 to 50% of the CPUs get shipped to like 10 companies.
Mm, yeah, no, that's, and, yes, it's more than 50%. So, I heard 60, yeah. 70, yeah. So because nobody's upgrading. Dozen, in the enterprise, we don't need to upgrade to new gen. We take too long to upgrade. Yeah.
Right. So if you take the 36 largest SaaS companies and infrastructure as a service companies as an aggregated pool, we're going to see, you know, we've seen, you know, 4 to 5% of IT spending, but, you know, 30% of infrastructure spending get consolidated into that pool. This is, you know, known as demand side consolidation. When you have, if that accelerates, like I'm willing to bet 20% of all IT spending and, you know, greater than 50% of all infrastructure spending will be consolidated, probably 70% will be consolidated to these, you know, 36 companies within the next 4 or 5 years. If that happens, look at the margins, right?
Well, the margins they make are phenomenal.
But the margins the infrastructure companies make that sell to them. You know, when you sell to 2,000 enterprise companies that buy a couple million bucks a year, you can make some good money. When you sell to seven companies,
yes,
total,
you've got a problem because they can dictate terms to you as the supplier.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, well, I think it's more complicated than that too. Although I'm not a huge fan. But I don't believe that public cloud will dominate in 5 years. Like AWS today is a $4 billion a quarter business. Cisco's a $12 billion a quarter business. So it's got a lot of growth to be able to suck away business from Oracle and Cisco. Now, that's not to say it's not damaging those businesses, and absolutely they need to do something about preventing AWS from growing if they can. But I think that's the other side of SDN, is that it's no longer going to be I've just come back from a conference, and the discussion across everybody was, how do you have a WAN that terminates in AWS or Azure Private Cloud or Google, you know, Google Compute Engine, GCE, as well as in my private data center? And they may not even be there now, but they're going to be in the future. And it's not just whether you terminate your WAN there. How do I now connect my data center to it and then get some, you know, get connectivity between them? What does that look like? Is that private addressing, public addressing? Is it VPNs? How do I scale VPNs to operate at 10, 20, 40, 50 gigabits per second? You know, how do I have some sort of visibility across the estate end to end?
You're hitting on a lot of the core problems, which is, you know, one of the reasons I like, you know, Azure, like as a property, is that I feel, especially with Office 365, they get hybrid better than anybody else. And, you know, the services where they're, you know, and I mean, Amazon does this as well, but the services where they integrate, I can connect an MPLS VPN back to an Equinix facility with like two clicks. Mm. I mean, think how amazing that is. Just like, you know, as a guy who's had to set MPLS VPNs up, like with a web UI and a handful of clicks, I can create a MPLS VPN that terminates in a rack in Equinix where my router is.
Yes.
That's awesome.
But it also, but you can't do, there's lots of things you cannot do, right? So
they terminate it,
but it's Q&Q and that's it, right?
Yeah.
So you get an Ethernet port that does Q&Q, ba-boom. But you have to then go and do a deal with Equinox, you have to get a rack, you still, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Oh,
right?
yes. I mean,
but it's a lot easier then.
A large variety of constraints. But by the way, I can do an IP VPN and terminate it back over the internet somewhere. I'm just saying, like,
well, you can, but you can't.
It's amazing I can do MPLS, though.
But, well, configuring Azure to do VPN is actually effectively impossible. if you actually go and try and do it, you'll discover that there's a whole bunch of things that Azure's and AWS's standard IVPNs don't do, like network address translation or terminating on a dynamic IP. There's just a whole bunch of things that just it's a complete fail.
Yeah. But because they're operating the virtual network connected back as opposed to a public one. But yes, I agree with you.
You can't publish private routes out the front end, for example, or a whole bunch of things, right? And as a general rule, the service is pretty much useless for any sort of sustained use, right? It's like, and you end up going back to where you were before and running up an ES instance and trying to terminate VPNs, which always ends badly because it doesn't perform very well. So it's not like this solution is magic. There are answers, but they're not good ones.
Well, that's why we've seen a lot of the resellers shift from, I'm a Cisco shop that schleps hardware, to we do cloud integration. Right, we help you between NetSuite and Salesforce and Amazon and Azure, and you know it is an evolution for the systems integrator slash a value added reseller that actually believes in the VA portion of that as opposed to the R portion of that acronym.
I have a pet theory that the whole concept of distribution reseller vendor distribution reseller customer that surely is ripe for disruption in the near future. I don't know what.
Unfortunately, a lot of it's protected by regulatory issues, right? So regulatory and tax, because the international resellers are some of the strongest resellers I've seen, right? I go to Europe and I find a much different depth of technology in most of the resellers there than I find in the average reseller in the U.S. And I think the reason is one, the companies tended to ship product over through Venray, and then the resellers pick it up, and they're the primary sales and support channel for it in many of those markets, especially for early stage companies.
Oh yeah, not true. For example, in Asia and Europe, your average reseller is far more talented, got actual deep skill sets in house because they're actually that much further away from the vendor. The vendor can always just the tendency for people in the US to get on a plane. It always shocks me. It's like it's like some sort of ego trip to get on a plane and pretend that you're important.
Let me assure you, there's no joy in getting on a plane, but I do like having my United 1K status when I get the upgrade occasionally. But, we promised 40, 45 minutes. You and I are pushing 90, my friend.
Okay. Well,
I actually have a board meeting I have to get to, so I hate to cut you short.
Wow. We've only just scratched the surface here, people.
I know.
Thank you.
Can we do this again?
We certainly should. We should do this in a few months. You're off to do something exciting, I believe.
I'm actually trekking up Mount Everest to base camp, Camp One type stuff, starting on Sunday.
Because, that's what nerds do, right?
Nerds that want good selfies. I'm bringing the best selfie stick you've ever seen, dude. Trust me.
You told me about it.
I'm going to have a drone to follow me. It's going to be great.
Well, come back and tell me about it, and I'll try and link something or Twitter it out to people. Can people follow you on the internet, Doug?
At DGorlay on Twitter. It's always the best.
All right. Fantastic. So thanks very much to Doug Goulet for joining us today. And thank you for your time and attention to listen to what we've been talking about. This is another one of our Future of Networking series where we sort of roam freely across the landscape or the futurescape that might be or might not be, and try and get people in to talk about these and break away some of the ideas about where we're actually going. As always, you can find this and many more other fine and free podcasts on our website at packetpushers.net. You can find us also on the Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook, if they're your favorite flavors of social media to keep up to date. We don't participate too often in those, in Facebook and LinkedIn, but we do publish the information, so if you want to track the latest shows. You too can also blog. Maybe you're interested in sharing your knowledge or your views with the Packet Pushers. You can actually come and blog. Anybody's welcome to join our community of bloggers there. And if you've got any feedback, don't hesitate to email us to packetpushers@gmail.com. If you do like the show, if you've loved what you've heard, please head on up to iTunes and leave a review or tell your friends. We'd love to have more people listening to the show. It certainly helps us to grow the business and to continue to deliver this as things go forward. Thanks again to Doug Goulet for joining us today. And as always, remember that too much technology would never be enough.